Good morning and welcome to a very special seminar. We're honored to have with us John Wilson, Professor Emeritus of Church History at Pittsburgh Theological Seminary. He will speak on the Puritan vision for New England. And I know this will be a great session, and we really thank Professor Wilson for agreeing to do it today. And then next week, we start a four-week series on the civil rights movement from its origins to its legacy in the present. And it will be led by Derek Woodard Lehman, a lecturer in theology and ethics at Pittsburgh Seminary. He was with us last June talking about polarization in America. And he's a wonderful presenter, and I think his series will be quite intriguing. So I hope to see you all next week. And now on to the Puritans.
Thank you, Sarah. Is this working? That's good. Let's begin with a word of prayer. Lord, we thank you for waking us to this beautiful day. And we thank you also for all that it means for us in terms of possibilities and challenges. And now may our teaching and learning be acceptable in your sight. O Lord, our strength and our Redeemer. Amen. Well, you see from the picture, this is 1645. So remember, we have Plymouth Colony, 1620. We have Massachusetts Bay, 1630. And this picture is 1645, England. But you notice some things about it right away, that the family seems to be quite well off, right? If you could see it closer, you would see very fine detail, especially in the man's collar. And she, as a woman of her time, is also quite well dressed. And there is something to be learned here, that the pilgrims, I should say the Puritans. The Puritans were typically a fairly well-off group. They represent the rising middle class that's very much associated with Parliament. But a class that in many ways, already at the time of 1600 or earlier at the time of Elizabeth, a class of people that are doing quite well. Some indeed are wealthy. They are not nobles. They are not part of the gentry, but they are or the noble gentry anyway. But they are part of a wealthy, increasingly wealthy group. And they're aware of it. We come to John Winthrop. I'm going to show you his picture in a second. Winthrop is even lord of the manor, and he is not noble. But his family has acquired wealth and influence, and they are owners of a large area of land, and he is officially titled Lord of the Manor. So the Puritans represent a rising group, the middle class. They identify closely with Parliament and the wars and the conflicts between nobles, kings, and Parliament. And out of this group will come the Puritan Revolution in the 1640s in England, and then also our Westminster Confession. Out of this group, and out of a group that thinks very much like the group that go to New England. As a matter of fact, people from New England, settlers from New England, will go back to England in support of Parliament when the wars begin. So we have a back and forth, and Parliament is quite aware of the New England settlement. they're in constant contact insofar as the ships go back and forth. So let's go to the next one. Ed? Okay, the Puritan Party. Who are they? They are the Protestants. They are the one wing of the Protestant group under Elizabeth. Now, Elizabeth, you remember when Elizabeth comes to power, she has the problem of having at least half her country Catholic. And Protestants have survived by the time she comes to the throne, survived the persecutions of Bloody Mary, when 300 clergy were burned at the stake, literally burned, in Mary's attempt to reverse Protestantism, to extinguish Protestantism. And of course, she does not succeed. And we have Elizabeth. And Elizabeth faces the problem, how is she going to unite her country, Catholics and Protestants? And the solution is the Church of England. Well, Church of England, under the Elizabethan solution, means generally, we can say in a general way, specifics are different. You could look it up and so forth. But generally, Protestant theology with Catholic usages, for example, Vespers. And under Elizabeth, these Catholic usages are law. So you have to belong to the Church of England, for one thing, and people who are in the ministry, the ministers have to conform to these Catholic ways. Now, there was give and take here. A lot depended on the bishop, the local bishop, and a lot depended on the attitude of people. But generally, there was conformity with objection. General conformity with objection characterizes non-separatist Puritans, non-separatist Puritans. That is to say, they have no interest in really separating from the Church of England. They have great interest in correcting it. So one of the things, certainly trying to get rid of Catholic forms, getting rid of bishops, so that also that Catholic forms, one of the most very common required was that the ministers wear the surplice. The surplice is that white frock that goes over the black gown, strictly identified with Catholic tradition, which in budding Protestantism, this was done without. So again, to purify the church, but not to separate from it. Right, we go to the next one. Mayflower. And the Mayflower pilgrims were separatists. They literally separated from the Church of England. The group that will go to Massachusetts Bay in 1630 were not separatists. Again, the hope was to reform the Church of England itself completely, but they didn't want to separate. For one reason, because the theology of the Church of England in the Book of Prayer, Book of Common Prayer, was Protestant. They had no intention of getting rid of that. But so we have this difference among the pilgrims, separatists, and separatists were definitely persecuted. Non-separatists could also be persecuted. As a matter of fact, they were. This was one of the problems when we get to the migration on the Arabella. They are being persecuted. Something happens. King Charles I comes to the throne. He appoints an archbishop who's adamant about persecuting the Protestants to bring them, the Puritans, to bring them back in line, to make sure they toe the line. But the separatists, the pilgrim group, separated early, around a little after 1600. And in 1607, they will flee England to get away from persecution. As the law of the land was you had to belong to the Church of England. This was also true of Catholics. And Catholics, of course, also objected to the settlement, to Elizabeth's settlement. But they also had to conform under law. They will continually pull the Catholics, like the Pilgrims will pull in the Catholic direction, and Pilgrims will pull, Puritans more in the Protestant direction. So we have these kinds of tensions inside the Church of England. But the separatists separate entirely. They consider the Church of England lost. It's in such terrible error, it makes no sense whatsoever to stay within the Church of England. And they go to Holland to get away from persecution. And in Holland, they have a fairly unhappy time. They do find political, religious refuge, certainly. They have freedom there for worship in Holland because they're compatible with the Dutch form of Protestantism. But they have very little chance for really practicing their own professions. Some can, but most cannot, and they're living in fairly humble circumstances. Some indeed, very bad circumstances. And the children that they're bringing up are not in the best of situations. So now these are Puritans who back in England were doing quite well, but in Holland they're not doing well. They are really suffering. So they will be in touch with trading companies about setting up a merchant fleet or a merchant colony, or to join the merchant colony in Jamestown. That's where they think they're going. They think they're going to Jamestown because they've already got a colony in Jamestown. So it's a merchant enterprise. It has to be financed, and the financing has to do with making money. And they finally managed to get it. They even have to get permission from England to settle at an English colony, and they actually get it. And then we have the history of the Pilgrims going to Plymouth, and it is a terrible history from the ship, from the voyage over in the fall of all times to go through the North Atlantic in the fall, right into November when they finally land. And they have suffered awfully on board. And then that winter, of course, you know the history of Plymouth, very famous, the fact that the Indian helped them survive. So that's Plymouth. Well, 10 years later, we have a new enterprise. And this is striking because they will be able to get a charter under the king, under King Charles I. Now, Charles I is known for being a Catholicizing king, that he marries a Catholic, and he favors very much policies that have to do with Catholics. Now, this is a time when we're getting religious wars on the continent, and they're going badly against the Protestants, against French Huguenots, and against German Protestants. Things are not going well. We're in the middle of the 30 Years' War. And Charles is not helping the Protestants. He's rather helping Catholics, not in any terribly overt way, but that's what he's doing. And the Puritans are reacting to this. And of course, in Parliament is full of Puritan sympathizers or Puritans themselves. Parliament's very much identified with the Puritan cause because of all the people in Parliament are mainly Puritans in their sympathies. So this kind of give and take creates problems, great problems. And the prospect of going to New England, of settling in New England, becomes more and more attractive. So we have a new effort underway. And one of the things that's remarked in the history is that it's quite amazing that John Winthrop and Massachusetts Colony Foundation were able to get a charter because the king had to approve the charter. And here you have a group of Puritans going to New England to settle. And this time they know where they're going. They're going directly to the area where Plymouth Colony is. And they get the charter. No one understands quite how they got it. And they depart in April 1630 and arrive in June. So they're 2 months underway. And there are three ships in this group, the Arabella and two others, and there are 400 people. After them, they're expecting 600 more right soon. And they know where they're going. They have a target. And one of the reasons why they know isn't just because of Plymouth, but because ever since the Jamestown Foundation, the Jamestown Colony, English ships have been going up and down that coast. They've been trading with Indians. Little fishing colonies have been established here and there. The French have established a little colony off the coast of Maine. So we're getting a lot of activity before 1630. So John Winthrop is a major leader in this group. And we see Winthrop, Ted. We have him. Okay, you notice the collar. Now it's a sign of wealth and a sign of status. Winthrop again was Lord of the Manor, very high placed Puritan. He had governmental responsibilities. He was not in Parliament, but he had all kinds of, well, different kinds of responsibility politically. He was a recognized political figure. And when the Massachusetts Bay Company could win him to be a leader, it was quite a win, and a win for the Puritans, because he was quite a leader. He was the first governor of the Massachusetts Bay Colony. We go to the next. Model of Christian charity, the sermon that John Winthrop preached, even though he was not himself clergy, on board the Arabella. His training was law, Cambridge law. And this, something I haven't mentioned before, I have to mention now, the Puritans were highly educated. And their kind of educational base, where they had the greatest influence, where they had theologians teaching theology for the Church of England, was Cambridge. They're very much identified with Cambridge and have been for at least 50 years prior to the 1630 voyage. And Winthrop was trained at Cambridge in law. He was a practicing lawyer, and this was part of, certainly has to do with his success in England before he leaves. My goodness, somebody's trying to call me. Okay, let's look at the, Winthrop begins with the providential diversity of material wealth or lack of it among human beings to the end that all may work together with the biblical reminder that all wealth belongs to God. That's an interesting place to start. He starts with these differences, class differences, but then all these are supposed to work together for the good of the whole, and with a strong reminder with several texts quoted that all wealth belongs to God. Okay, the next one. There are two rules whereby we are to walk towards another, justice and mercy. There is likewise a double law by which we are regulated in our conversation towards one another. By the first of these laws, one is commanded to love his neighbor as himself. Upon this ground stands all the precepts of the moral laws which concern our dealings with others. Now, certainly you recognize the New Testament, right? And this is definitely where he's getting almost everything. He's getting it into the sermon. It's certainly biblical and very strongly from Paul. The next one. To apply this to the works of mercy, this law requires two things. First, that every person afford his help to another in every want or distress. And secondly, that he perform this out of the same affection which makes him careful of his own goods, according to that of our Savior, Matthew 7:12, whatsoever ye would that men should do to you, you do to them. So again, strong biblical injunction. And thirdly, the next one. The gospel commands love to an enemy. And lastly, when there is no other means whereby our Christian brother may be relieved of his distress, we must help him beyond our ability. This duty of mercy is exercised in the minds of giving, in the kinds of giving, lending, and forgiving a debt. And the next one. What rule shall one follow in giving in respect of measure? If the time and occasion be ordinary, he is to give out of abundance. Let him lay aside as God hath blessed him. If the time and occasion be extraordinary, he must be ruled by them, taking this withal, that then a man cannot likely do too much, especially if he may leave or keep himself and his family under probable means of comfortable subsistence. You see, these are New Testament. These are the morals of the New Testament of a Christian life now being applied to what is a civic enterprise, the foundation of a colony. Go further. What rule must be observed in lending? Thou must observe whether thy brother has present or probable possible means of repaying thee. If there be none of those, thou must give him according to his necessity, rather than lend him as he requires. If he hath present means of repaying thee, thou art to look at him not as an act of mercy, but by way of commerce, where thou art to walk by the rule of justice. But if his means of repaying thee be only probable or possible, then is he an object of thy mercy. These striking rules for a colony. Next one. If he hath nothing to pay thee, thou must forgive. In all these and like cases, Christ gives a general rule. Whatsoever ye would that men should do to you, do ye the same to them. The affection from which this mercy arises is, as the apostle tells us, love is a fulfilling of the law. And the next one. Ye are the body of Christ. All the parts of this body are made so contiguous as they must partake of each other's strength and infirmity, joy and sorrow, weal and woe. This sensitivity and sympathy of each other's conditions will necessarily infuse into each part a desire and endeavor to strengthen, defend, preserve, and comfort the other. Okay, the next one. The end of our undertaking is to improve our lives, to do more service to the Lord, the comfort and increase of the body of Christ, whereof we are the members, that ourselves and posterity may be the better preserved from the common corruptions of this evil world, to serve the Lord and work out our salvation under the power and purity of his holy ordinances. And then the next, we must love one another with pure heart. We must bear one another's burdens. Neither must we think that the Lord will bear with such failings at our hands as he doth from those among whom we have lived previously in England. And I'm going to pause there just a second to talk about the problems in England at the time. Bad things were happening. The church was certainly there, but kind of laissez-faire attitude everywhere. Yes. Oh, we went too far. Go back. The end of our undertaking. Give you an example. I think it's the best of the examples. Christmas. Puritans are known for abolishing Christmas. Well, certainly one of the reasons was they didn't see it in the New Testament. They also were well educated enough to know, to understand how things happened in the early church. They're quite well educated. And they know Roman history. They know the history of the Saturnalian. That time of year when we celebrate Christmas was a huge pagan feast. And what they were saying was Christmas has now become more like a Roman Saturnalian than having anything to do with the holy days. And you can hear the complaints, not just among Puritans, but among others, that the 12 days of Christmas, the 12 days of Christmas were riotous, downright riotous, especially among the youth in schools, at the university level, for example, but elsewhere. There were terrible things going on during the 12 days of Christmas. But this, I think, was a major motive in not celebrating Christmas, because it had such a terrible reputation. We have Puritan families, we know that did celebrate Christmas in a very quiet way. They spent it in prayer, recognizing it, but that was not normal procedure. Generally, they just waited for the next Sunday. Sunday services were the main thing. Here again, what were they reacting against when they left England? What did they hope not to carry over into the new colony? What was going to be different? Okay, the next one, Ted. We must love one another with pure heart. We must bear one another's burdens. Neither must we think that the Lord will bear with such failings at our hands as he does from those among whom we have lived previously in England. Okay, the next one. Thus stands the cause between God and us. We are entered into a covenant, and that's highly important. We are entered into a covenant with God for this work. The Lord hath given us leave to draw up our own articles. We have hereupon besought him to favor and blessing. Now, if the Lord shall please to hear us and bring us peace to the place we desire, then hath he ratified this covenant. Then hath he ratified the covenant. So we're looking for the will of God in the things that happen. Now, this is very Puritan. But the next slide. But if we shall neglect the observation of these articles, and dissembling with our God shall fall to embrace this present world, and prosecute our carnal intentions, seeking great things for ourselves and our posterity, the Lord will sure break out in wrath against us and make us know the price of the breach of such a covenant. Now, that's a very powerful line, and it's very important to understand the Puritans, understand their understanding of how they related to God and how God relates to them. Now, the next one. Now, the only way to avoid this shipwreck and to provide for our posterity is to follow the counsel of Micah 6:8, to do justly, to love mercy, to walk humbly with our God. For this end, we must entertain each other in brotherly affection. We must be willing to abridge ourselves of our superfluities for the supply of others' necessity. We must uphold a familiar commerce together in meekness, gentleness, patience, and liberality. And we go to the next one. We must delight in each other, make others' conditions our own, rejoice together, mourn together, labor and suffer together. So shall we keep the unity of the Spirit in the bond of peace. The Lord will be our God and delight to dwell among us as his own people, and will command a blessing upon us in all our ways. He shall make us a praise and glory that men shall say of succeeding endeavors, may the Lord make it like that of New England. Now that's a strong, strong vision of what they think they are, what they think they're doing. And the next one, this is the most famous line in the sermon. But we must consider that we shall be as a city upon a hill. The eyes of all people are upon us. Now that's a bit of an exaggeration, but certainly the eyes of England were there, above all the eyes of Puritan England, a city on a hill. This goes over into American history. It's in the inaugural addresses of several presidents. It's there with Kennedy, and I think Obama used it too. A city set on a hill. We are the eyes in the eyes of all people. Famous line, very strong, famous line. And we go to the last. And this is very, very important to understanding the Puritans. The sermon closes with reference to Deuteronomy 30. The last exhortation of Moses. The people, Moses addressing the people now have the choice for life, meaning obedience that God will bless, or the choice for death, which means disobedience and the consequence of worshiping other gods. That's in Deuteronomy 30, the last words of Moses to the people, a choice for life, choice for death. And then the closing words of the sermon. Therefore, let us choose life that we and our seed may live by obeying his voice and cleaving to him, for he is our life and our prosperity. End of the sermon. So I think it's a striking piece of work. And let me go ahead and read a comment on the New England Enterprise. This is from Samuel Eliot Morison. Some of you may know quite well his histories, American history, Samuel Eliot Morison. This is what he writes about New England. New England, in the long run, proved to be no more a city of God than old England. Moral intensity and spiritual virility evaporated. And we know from the history, we can trace the problems. It did. And yet for our purposes today, and for the America of the future, this courageous adventure of seeking to live the New Testament life in the wilds of the New World cannot be deemed a failure. The important thing is they had faith, that they were stout-hearted for an ideal and sought the light of a higher power than their own wants and wills. The spirit of New England Puritanism still survives, and it will be a sad day for the Republic if it dies. So I come to the end. Yes, Bobby. Yes.
Oh, okay. Shall I repeat that? I said, I'm surprised at how much of what we now call the social gospel is really basic to this. It's the heart of it, it seems to me. So
I agree.
I want to move there.
It's as a vision for a colony. That's clearly a holy colony, right? Based on faith and clearly biblical principles, biblical understandings. This is set out not just for a church. This is for a colony. This is for a colonial undertaking. Well, yes. Yeah.
To what degree was this controversial in the colony?
Say it again.
To what degree was this controversial in the colony?
The sermon doesn't seem to have been controversial at all. It was understood as where they were, how they understood what they were doing. John?
Thinking of our democracy, our American, the Constitution is based on the people. That's the highest authority. What a mess. The people, as if the people contained this high vision. And we can see that that's not the case. But in all the law, the highest principle in a democracy is the people. You know, things are decided by vote. And the people, whatever motivates them, has nothing to do with this higher vision.
I think I got most of it. Ted, can you help me some?
This is just a statement. You don't have to respond. That's just a...
No, I need to understand everything. The last of it?
I think he was saying that the highest authority in the Constitution is the people. And so how do you reconcile that with this notion that we're answerable to God and not the people? Did I get that right, John?
Yeah. Well, we go through history, right? Middle of the 1600s, Descartes is writing. So we have the beginning of the Enlightenment. And the Enlightenment changes a great deal. But one of the things that Enlightenment continues, it was already in Puritanism, with rationalism. The Puritans are highly reasonable in everything they do. They are at Cambridge, they excel in the sciences, and they're very interested in the sciences. When Harvard is formed quite quickly in Massachusetts with a curriculum, not only for ministers, but in the sciences. The Puritans are quite aware of the sciences and they pursue them. Nature is revelation of the will of God. So they are hardly anti-science, but all of this interest in science and rationality that we find with the Puritans will go over into Enlightenment, kind of the bridge. rationalism will continue. But we get into enlightenment and things change very definitely. We get away from Puritan piety and we're into general reason. Deism and so forth become popular among the intellectuals. That happens in the 1700s. John Locke, the great Enlightenment figure, is writing in the 1690s. Things are rapidly developing. So we're leaving Puritanism behind, but it stands there as what it was, as this ideal for what a colony, a divine, God's colony, so to speak, in the New World should be. And they always thought it would have a back effect onto England. They would influence what happened in England. When England saw how well they succeeded in what they were doing, England would follow. So what happens in England? Puritan Revolution in the 1640s, and we get a war. Parliament, mainly Puritan, against Cavaliers, the king, and the nobles who were supporting the king. So things certainly do come to a critical point as time moves. But we also know that the original fervor of the first group in the second generation fades, and every generation after that fades more. And I think this is true probably of every church foundation. An initial fervor and then decline. The generations that come after do not carry that original fervor unless some individuals rediscover it and try to rekindle it for a religious tradition. But that seems to be characteristic of the way religious traditions develop, with great fervor in the beginning and then a loss as time goes. And this can be traced also for New England. It happens. Could we have Ted?
I can't help but think as we go through this about this concept of us founding a Christian nation and the popular articulation of that, that is radically at odds with what these founding people conceived as a Christian nation. The folks who is, you know, when people today try to call, describe America as a Christian nation, it couldn't be more radically different than what is described in this sermon.
Well, it's one of the things that's interesting about American history with this covenant idea, the idea of covenant, is that again and again and again, we get church groups, splinter groups, major denominations picking up covenant. We covenant. And the covenants look something like this. That is to say, they start with great intentions and fervor for a purpose, and intend that their posterity should also have this. The posterity will, of course, with time, we've said, decline. We can't see. It's the old problem. How do you keep original fervor for anything? But this happens in American history ever and ever again. Covenants, whether they're, we can call them church covenants, but they're also secular covenants. Social gospel efforts can be church or outside of church. But they're little covenants with each other for a certain end. Churches covenant generally with God to include, it is the will of God that with that they are covenanting. So this has, I mean, it happens again and again and again. I agree with you that it, by and large, it doesn't look very Christian, but still these things happen. Now, is Christianity today on decline, generally? Or will, and if in the midst of all that, will there be these regenerative efforts, little covenants here and there of Christian people kindled for a new beginning? I don't know. But I just know in history it's happened. Look at the Methodists. John Wesley has a clear covenant of personally with God as to what he's going to do. And among the Methodists, there are covenant churches. So it's in the Westminster Confession, covenant thought. Maybe we could go to the last one. We got it? Okay, that's the image, the bad image of the Puritan. That was erected in Springfield, Massachusetts, 1858. And so in the 19th century, 1858, it's supposed to represent a founder of Springfield, Massachusetts. But that has come to represent the authoritarian Puritan. Whenever you see Puritan criticism, often that picture is included. How do you respond to the picture? That's a statue in Springfield. How do you react to that? Is it negative? Is it positive? Neutral? Neutral? Yeah, it's supposed to be the Bible.
Yes. Yeah, I was asking what he was holding in his left hand, and you said it was the Bible?
It was supposed to be the Bible.
Oh, okay.
Confident, challenged, moving forward. Maybe a bit pompous.
Yeah, well, certainly been taken to represent male dominance, right?
Well, yeah.
Male authority. Yes, and
well, then what happened to the pietism that served them very well, that people seem to rebel against, that brought religious reformations, you know, afterwards in the 1700s, the second, first and second.
Awakenings, yeah.
Oh, awakenings, yes. What did it, they have a reputation of being dour, of life being tedious. That's what I thought.
The Puritans.
The Puritans.
Well, we know, actually, family life was generally nice. That is to say, they prized family life, and they concentrated a lot on family life. At the same time, they had strict rules, and the families were, you might put it like this, your ideal family obeys the rules. They, you know, the mothers and fathers act like mothers and fathers should, and the children love their parents and so forth. But then when things start to break down, you get different kinds of problems. And over time, the problems were there. Now, one great difference, the Great Awakening of in the 1700s, we talk about John Wesley, George Whitefield. The Great Awakening sermons were typically highly emotional or evoked motion, were evocative of emotion, high emotion. So we get, there's a story, for example, John Wesley walked into the church and the first row fainted, right? Because he has such powerful religious influence. And Wesley made a point of in his sermons, as did George Whitefield, of exciting emotion, because this was important. It was the Holy Spirit working, was to excite emotion. So he might have been very bland in talking, but the zeal, the aim was to excite emotion. The Puritan sermon was sober. They were known for the sobriety. So in this sermon, for example, There is no inducement to get up and holler, right? But to do emotional things. Yeah, that's just not there. Altogether, they are sober. And the Puritan sermons, we have many, many copies of Puritan sermons where you can read. And they are very rational, straightforward sermons. This is what God has done for us. This is what the New Testament says. And it's just laying it out like that. And you surely know that in New England, in this Commonwealth, only the Puritan believers, only those who were truly in the church could vote. So we have a Puritan Commonwealth. Not everyone votes. With time, that will change, certainly. But initially, it's the members of the church that govern the state, with John Winthrop at the top. And this is concept of a holy commonwealth, ruled by the saints. The point is not to just let anybody in to government, but to have a government that it is as holy as the church, in its intentions anyway. And this is true in Massachusetts for a long time. Slowly they will change, because by 1850, Massachusetts Bay Colony has a population of almost 3,000 with 12 towns. That's in 20 years. So things are happening very fast. And not only are Puritans coming, but non-Puritans. People are coming for opportunity. And one of the things we certainly also know is that Massachusetts gets rich. Timber, trading timber back to Europe, fish, the fish industry, they do in fact get wealthy. And as a matter of fact, William Bradford, the great leader of the Plymouth Colony, he writes a history of Plymouth Colony. And he says they failed because they got rich. They failed because they got rich. It doesn't actually say they failed, but it went down. It declined because they got rich. And we know little things happened. Little things like that showed the change. For example, in England, a community lived together, and they would walk out to the farms. So you have a community village of people living together who walk out to the farm. What happens in Massachusetts? They find it's more economical to go live near the farm, because you can farm more land. You can do a larger tract. Hey, another interesting fact, these things keep popping into my mind. You know, the Indian population, Massachusetts, was pretty much decimated before the Puritans arrived, because through these contacts up and down the coast, the people coming, you know, traders, fishers, big fishing boats, smallpox, plague, have decimated the Indian population. So when the Puritans arrive in Massachusetts, the land is open. The Indians are there, but by no means in the numbers they were before. So they have no difficulty settling. They definitely have difficulty adjusting in the beginning. Very many die, also in the Massachusetts colony. In Plymouth, it's horrendous. Half of everybody dies in the Plymouth colony in the first year. There's also great death in the Massachusetts colony. And very many who've come after that first time over will go back, because they can't take it. It's just too rough. Very many die. But those who hold on will establish a very successful colony. More comments? John?
You're a historian. Can I ask a philosophical question?
Sure, you can answer. I'm not sure I can answer. Okay.
How do you define history? Are things getting better? Are they getting worse? What is history in your mind?
Ted, can you help me with that?
He's looking for your definition of history, and I would extrapolate the arc of history. Are things getting better or worse?
Today.
Across history.
Is history getting better? You mean is time getting
better? Is the arc of history, the progression of humanity through history, are things getting better or worse? Are we getting any better at this?
And you're asking me.
Yeah. You're on the spot.
That's something I can't answer. I'm not.
No, I'm just asking. It says the arc of history bends toward justice, and lots of people say this.
Right? We don't kill each other first.
But that's for.
Talar de Chardin, if you know the concept, thinks we are progressing definitely. With every setback, there is still, even with the setback and in the setback, setback contributes to the new progress. And things are definitely progressing. So he recognizes the terrible things that happened. Certainly he's writing after the Second World War. He knows about those things, but he still thinks there is progress and that it can't be stopped. He thinks it's part of what God has put into the evolutionary process of humanity. It's bound to progress in spite of the destruction. There's a philosopher, though, and I don't know if you know this, I could think of his name, I couldn't tell you. Philosopher who says that we are heading for a class war, the haves against the have-nots. And that in many ways seems to be happening, what we see today. People crowding the borders, for example, you know, trying to get to the benefits of what this country has to offer, also elsewhere. So that's a philosopher. It's definitely predicting a final class war. Doesn't say how it's going to come out. I think as Christians, if you look at the book of Revelations, it's not always terribly hopeful because there are bad things that happen in the final days. So John, I don't have an answer for you. I can give you another book.
So you asked about the reaction to the statue, and a reaction I have is it kind of begs the question, is this guy authoritative or authoritarian? And part of that answer might be, you know, might relate to whether or not he is offering this structure as a perfect authority or as a flawed human who says, you're going to do what I say. And then that takes me to the next question of how much did these guys believe in grace and human frailty? Because if you listen to that sermon, it's kind of like, let's all try and be perfect, and then we don't have to worry about grace.
Well, they were certainly also authoritarian. And if opportunity arises, I would go back into the Puritan history and show the decline and the problems they had establishing, trying to establish a holy commonwealth. Because they could be quite intolerant. But that was not unusual for the time. All those countries were intolerant, Catholic and Protestant. That is to say, they had a standard church of the country, a national church, and people belonged to that. And we do not get a change in that until we get to the end of the 30 Years' War. Peace of Westphalia, 1648, where for the first time in history, we have a significant state, Germany, settling the conflict between the confessions by putting them on equal basis, tolerance of each other. First time in history, toleration, Catholics and Protestants. And that's where the way they settled the 30 years war, a war that absolutely devastated Europe. Absolutely devastated it. All kinds of incredible cruelties in that war. And they come to the end just in exhaustion and settle it. Tolerance.
I just look at that guy's picture and it doesn't call to mind somebody who's talking about his personal need for God's grace. Yeah, you know, it's like, I've got the answer.
Yeah, yeah. The Scarlet Letter was written about 8 years before this statue was erected. And of course, the Scarlet Letter is a very heavy indictment of Puritans. And just as a, by the way, a little aside, Connecticut had the Scarlet Letter rule. And the Scarlet Letter was very rare, hardly ever happened, but it wasn't scarlet. It was either black or gray. And A. Thank you very much. Thanks.